Listen, did you know that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat? Yeah, disgusting, right? It can lead to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. It's just really gross. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth. They require up to 3 times less laundry, too, which who doesn't want less laundry? Miracle Made sheets have incredible self-cooling properties for better quality sleep. Their silver-infused fabrics are inspired by NASA, and they are thermoregulating. That means they are specifically designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. Say goodbye to gross odors with the sheets' self-cleaning properties. And I also have to say, they're super duper comfortable and they don't have the high price tag of some of the other brands. Also, it's allergy season, y'all. So I don't know if you're like me, but I'm looking for a springtime refresh in my house, and I think you deserve one too. So go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you are not 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we are joined by Jose Olivares. Jose is an educator, award-winning poet, and author of a brand new poetry collection called Promises of Gold. I absolutely loved this poetry collection that started as a series of love poems to his homies and then grew to include the scope of a world dealing with mortality, grief, and tenderness in the face of COVID-19. We talk today about language and translation, love poems, and so much more. Remember, our March book club pick is the essay collection Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay. We will be back on March 29th with Shanita Hubbard for that discussion. Everything we talk about on each episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. If you love The Stacks and want more of it, like our incredible community on Discord, our bonus episodes, and our monthly virtual meetups to discuss our book club picks, you simply must join The Stacks Pack on Patreon. It's just $5 a month and you get all of that and more, and you get to know that you're a part of making this Black woman-run independent podcast a reality every single week. So head to patreon.com/thestacks to join. Special shout out to our newest members of the Stacks Pack, Lydia Holt, Lewis Wolfenden, Giselle Green, Denise Verugiz, Tamara Adebisi, and Joe Hughes. Thank you all so much, and thank you again to the entire Stacks Pack. All right, now it is time for my conversation with Jose Olivares. All right, everybody. It is March, and we are talking about a poetry collection because I don't only talk about poetry in April when the poems are super duper good. I'm joined today by Jose Olivares, who is the author of Promises of Gold, a brand new poetry collection. Jose, welcome to the Stacks.
Hi, Tracy. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to talk with you. I joke about that because I'm usually very bad at poetry, okay? I'm just throwing this out because you're apparently very good at poetry. So you're now going to get to talk to those of us who are failures. But before we get into that, in about 30 seconds or so, can you just tell the folks about your book?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started writing Promises of Gold during the pandemic and right before the pandemic. And it was my attempt to write love poems for all the people and homies that kind of have held me down as I've gone through various stages in my life. And as I was writing those love poems, the pandemic happened and a whole lot of other things happened, the uprisings of 2020, and it complicated those love poems. And so Promises of Gold is what happens when you try to live, when you try to write love poems, you know, amidst our complicated and sometimes cruel world.
Yeah. I want to start with, I guess, the outside of the book, in the early pages of the book. For folks who don't know, this book is published both in English and in Spanish. And I guess my first question is, why did you want to do it that way as opposed to having a translated copy that was a different book physically?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing is it's more accessible this way, right? So people don't have to spend their money twice. But the other thing is, for me, this is the first time that my parents will be able to read my poetry. I've talked about it. Yeah, I've talked about my poetry with them, but it's the first time that they'll be able to experience it on their own.
Do you speak Spanish? Because in your English poems, there is some Spanish language in there.
Yeah, Spanish is my first language. So yeah, I speak Spanish, but I don't feel super confident writing poetry in Spanish.
What is that? Can you talk more about that? Because I think it's interesting. I think most people would assume like, oh, it's your first language, you speak the language and you're a poet, you'd be able to do it in both. And you didn't. You have a translator who worked with you. So I'm just curious if you'd speak more to why that's difficult for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So my parents migrated to the United States from Mexico, and I went to school my whole life in English only classrooms. So I learned, you know, how to write with style and technique in English, whereas Spanish is more conversational and it's just a little bit harder to access the creative side of Spanish for me.
Did you ever try to translate your own poems and were like, no, not gonna be able to do it?
Yeah, I mean, of course I've tried to translate my own poems. It's hard. It feels like you're writing a different poem altogether.
Yeah. Have your parents read this book?
Yes. My mom and dad have both read this book. My brothers have read the book. They all really loved it. They said it made them cry at times. So it's cool. It's cool to have their support.
I'm going to start crying right now. That's the cutest thing I've ever heard. Okay. One more question about your translator, and then I'm going to move off of this. But I do think it's like really worthy of conversation because I've never seen a book like this before, I don't think. I don't know. I mean, again, I don't read a lot of poetry, so it could be like a thing poets are doing and I have no clue, but I think it's really cool. And so your book starts with an author's note and then your translator has a note where essentially your translator says you're not shit, basically, about you. he's like anyone who says America when they mean the United States. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of jokingly, but I mean, I want to talk about that a little bit. It was like such a moment for me because he's in the introduction, he sort of talks about some of the choices he makes. Like he talks about what it is to translate something, you know, he talks about Mexico and Mexicano, and he talks about like losing a letter and all this stuff. It's really interesting. I love the inside baseball of it all. But he talks about towards the end about he says each time the word America is used to name a country, except an American dream. Tangential. I've decided to say Estados Unidos. Why? Because America is a continent and not a country. The territory that goes from the Canadian Northwest to Patagonia is America. From Mexico to the South, we are not merely Latin America. I need to say this because when somebody uses the word America to mean the United States, they are omitting millions of people, thousands of miles of territory, countless cultures and languages. America is more than the USA, and many times this kind of reductionism leads to the oppression. For example, make America great again is a white supremacy slogan that erases people who don't meet certain standards, even if those people don't live in the United States. But we can't condemn Jose Olivares because he used the word America to mean the United States, because he hit back by saying America is toxic. So I'd love for you to hit back again. I'm going to start a fight between you two.
I really love that note, and I love that he included that explanation. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me. And, you know, I thought about in our conversations, in the editing process, going back and changing the title of that poem, you know, it's called American Tragedy, and changing it to United Statesian Tragedy or something like that. But I thought it was important for people to kind of see that even in our conversations, there's still potential to learn and continue to grow. So I appreciated the note from David. I think he's right on point. And I'm trying to like slow down and catch myself now whenever I do jump to use America as a country, right? To remember that America is not a country. We're not, you know, this is not the America. We're talking about the Americas, right? So yeah, that was a really big learning moment for me, for sure.
I loved it. I just, I, you can tell from reading this, from reading both of your notes, even just from the beginning, how collaborative it was between the two of you. And so were there times where you did change a poem or change a word because it translated better, or like he sent you his translation of a poem and you were like, oh, I want to change it in English too because it's not right or whatever?
I mean, there weren't really times where we went back to the English to try and change the English, but we did have tons of conversations over specific word choices in Spanish. So there's like a word that David uses, ochocientos mil, which is like, you know, a great, it's a fake number that means a great many, right?
Like 5011.
Exactly. So David, when he came across the word in English, I forget exactly what the English word is, but he presented me with a whole bunch of options. And so we would talk back and forth and not just talk about meaning, but also the music of the poem, right? Like something that I pride myself on is that I really believe that the English poems sound good and I wanted the Spanish poems to sound good out loud, right? So that was kind of the process. I'll say the one disagreement that we had was over the word for grass, which I translate to zacate and he uses césped. So that became like a big disagreement. We started an email and moved over to IG to like continue our disagreement.
Who won?
You know, honestly, I have to look back and check. I don't even remember.
Okay.
But
it sounds like you lost.
I probably.
You'd remember if you won.
Yeah. There you go.
Speaking of word choice, there, like I mentioned before, there's parts in the English poems where you use Spanish language words. How much agonizing did you do over that? Or was it just sometimes like, I have to use the Spanish word, the English word just doesn't hit?
Yeah. So there's kind of multiple reasons why I'll use a Spanish word, right? One is because the music of the Spanish word is just prettier. It adds a different element that the English translation doesn't add. The other thing that I listen for is there's certain textures that the words have in Spanish that the words in English don't have. And so, for example, one of my favorite words in Spanish is the word ojalá. Now, ojalá translates loosely to like hopefully, but ojalá is derived from inshallah, right? It comes, there's like a texture of spirituality and holiness to that word that gets lost when it's translated to hopefully. And so those are the kinds of things that I'm thinking about when I'm kind of deciding which word to use.
Right. And obviously you have, just from hearing you talk, but I think I know this about you from the people that you're friends with, you have a background in out loud poetry, spoken poetry, poetry performance. So you're really thinking about the music of the words and how it sounds and how it should be, how readers should receive it. And so I guess the question is about the translation of that. Like, how do you translate you getting up on stage and doing your poem and knowing the cadence and whatever to actually making it look the way that you hope will tell your readers to read it that way? And I know that you can't exactly do that, but every time I have a poet on, I talk about this. I have a performance background. So when I'm reading a poem, I'm taking line endings, punctuation, like the length of a line. I'm taking all of those things into account and saying like, okay, how should I read this? And I often do read poems out loud because I feel like there's clues just in how the words sound. But how are you thinking about giving me those clues?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, the process of going from reading a poem out loud to how it should be organized on the page is not simply like where I take a breath, that's where the line break goes. Because part of what makes, and I've learned this over time, right? Part of what makes reading poetry on a page exciting to me is that, you know, every line is its own unit. And so, and then, you know, you read two lines together and that's a different unit and it can complicate the meaning of each of those individual lines, right? And so for me, when I started writing, I didn't really like to use punctuation. I kind of just ended lines where the breath was and that was how I organized it. And now I'll use punctuation so that I can be a little bit more creative with the line breaks. And so for me, if I was trying to give someone a guide for how I would read the poem out loud, I would say kind of follow the punctuation more so than the line breaks.
You've deviated from my personal crusade. I'm a line break queen.
That's me, though. I think the important thing is, you know, I really believe that poetry is collaborative, right? So I start the poem, but it's not finished until the reader does whatever they do with it.
No, it's okay. I'm not really mad at you. It's just this is the thing that we talk about every time I talk to a poet, because it's so different. Everyone has a different thought or feeling about it. And I, again, come to it, I studied Shakespeare. So I have very strong feelings about iambic pentameter and what the punctuation versus the line ending means in a speech from Shakespeare or whatever. And so those are my skills that I come to a poetry book with. And so I'm always like, what are you thinking about it when you put it down? And, you know, like sometimes poems look cool, but then you try to read the way that it looks and you're like, it's not doing it. Like, it looks cool on the page, but clearly this was a poem that you wanted people to read off the page, and there's no chance you could perform it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to talk about your author's note one more time. I love it. I'm a big fan of when poets give me any clues about the work. How do you feel about it? Because I know it's sort of a contentious thing in the poetry world of like giving clues or answers to your readers, especially at the beginning of a collection.
I mean, I wrote the author's note, you know, before I even had the publishing contract. It was like part of what we used to get the publishing contract. And I didn't know that the publisher would want to include that note in the actual physical book. But I'm really glad they did, mostly because, you know, like we talked about, right? My kind of entrance into poetry was via spoken word. And that meant that when I tried to take those skills from going to a million poetry slams and open mics and trying to transfer that to the page, it was really hard for me at times to make sense of what was happening on the page in some people's poetry. And so I'm not too far removed from those days that I can't remember what it was like to like want so desperately to enter into a poem and find locked door after locked door. Right. So if I can make it a little bit easier, a little bit more welcoming, I'm all for that.
Thank you. It's much appreciated. It paid off, at least in my case. So we started talking about at the very beginning where this poetry collection came from. And in the author's note, you talk about how it was sort of like an ode to the homies. And then, you know, COVID happened and the world happened and 2020 happened and beyond. But I'd love for you to talk about why writing love poems to your friends was important. And especially I'm thinking about it after watching the media cycle about Michael B. Jordan and Jonathan Majors the last few weeks and like that like tenderness between them. And, you know, you talk a little bit about machismo in your book quite a bit, actually. And so I don't know, all of those things are sort of swirling in my brain. And I'd love for you to speak to what was swirling in yours.
Yeah. The media cycle was so wild because Jonathan Majors is like, he is the epitome of a certain type of masculinity, right? Like he's ripped, he's strong. And yet it just goes to show that there's no winning that game, right? There's no way to be machista enough or masculine enough. It doesn't matter how many muscles you have. I started thinking about writing love poems for my friends in part because I started writing the collection at this very particular moment where a lot of my friends were starting to get married and our friendships were starting to change in different ways, right? It went from, you know, when we were in our early 20s, we would squad up together and roll like 20 deep wherever we were going to. Now, you know, we're kind of spread across the country and we don't get to see each other as much. And so I was thinking about how special those relationships were and are, right? And how as they're changing, they remain special, but how we held each other together through so many heartbreaks, through getting fired at jobs, through deaths in the family, you know, through so much. And that's a really special type of relationship that just doesn't we don't spend enough time, I think, really thanking people for being there, right? It really feels like if it's not a romantic relationship, it kind of gets pushed to the side in cultural discourse.
Yeah, I wish more poets wrote about friends, because I really like that. And I feel like that's really relatable, right? Like, we all have friends at some point in our life, hopefully always. But like, I don't know, it's like people write poems about trees. I'm like, that friends are like trees. They're everywhere. Like, there's so much to talk about.
I love that. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true. You know, it's funny you say that. I was just in Arizona and I visited Sahuaro National Park, right? National park full of cacti. And I remember seeing these ancient cacti and just feeling like I was with the ancestors, and they're just like standing tall. And sometimes the cacti are like very close to each other and it kind of looks like they're hugging each other. I was just like, this is how we survive. Even in the desert, this is how we survive.
I feel a poem coming on.
Maybe.
I have a sense. I don't know. Please dedicate it to me. Thank you.
There you go.
No, but you have this great poem in a word you just mentioned, Ojala, and Ojala, My Homies, that poem. Oh my God, the end. Oh, I'm so emotional. It's about sneakers and friends and how you tuck your sneakers away because you didn't want to get you didn't want them to get ganked or whatever. And that's how you all learned to love, was to keep the things you love most close by and out of sight, like the sneakers. And I don't know, man, that one really just got to me. I mean, how do you hope these poems about like your deep love for your friends will be received or seen?
I mean, that was one of those flashbulb moments in my life. Like, I remember my friend, he was coming over to hang out, and he was just like, I just saw somebody get jumped for their shoes, and he was wearing the same shoes, you know? Right. My hope is that the poems will be shared with people. I know that, like, for example, I have a friend out in California who is book clubbing the book with like her boo and also her dad, you know? I think that's cool. So I hope that people will share the poems, and, you know, I don't know that they need to be used for, like, how do I put it? You know, and now let's talk about this, right? Like, I don't know that they need to be I guess I'm cool with however people use them, but I really hope that people will share them. And then maybe down the line, they'll have opportunities to talk about the different ways that we love and the different ways that we hold our emotions in, particularly when it comes to like men and masculine people.
So your book is broken into sections. There's 11, but the last three are all titled Glory, and Ojala, Ojala, Ojala comes up in two other sections. Talk to me about that. I mean, I know you made a choice. I just would love to know what you're thinking the three different glories are, or why separate them and all of that.
Yeah. So the organization of the book was the idea of my friend Nate Marshall, who I know you know.
Friend of the pod. We love Nate here. Yes. Big fans.
Absolutely. Nate is the person that I go to when my manuscript is almost done, but there's like a little something missing. And so I visited Nate, and his idea was that we should listen to the album by Common B. And so that album has 11 songs. And so we went about trying to organize these poems into 11 sections to kind of follow the movement of that album. We landed on the last three sections being called Glory because, one, you know, I think Nate was telling me that there's like an old church hymn called Glory, Glory, Glory. There's a song that goes Glory, Glory, Glory. And so we wanted to end it on this kind of upward note, on this song that is thinking about what is glory in our lives? What is the thing that is going to keep us and sustain us? And so that is why But even still, those poems are not always easy, right? Like the movement is not straight up. And so part of what I like is that each one is an attempt again. Like maybe the first glory fails at reaching that place, but then the next one is another attempt. And then you get one more attempt after that. So that's what I was hoping for, is that that kind of repetition and another try to like make something beautiful.
So, and when you're organizing, I'm always so curious about this, because you started writing this before the pandemic. Now we're in 2023. So clearly some of these poems are a lot older than others. When you figure out the organization, the 11 things, you have the different titles, how much of it is moving things that are already done into the correct place versus writing new things to fill up the different sections? Or is there a different process that you use?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both, right? Like part of it is definitely moving poems that I like into the correct sections that will give them the most kind of oomph for, in terms of like how they relate to the poems around them. But the other part is, once you get a look at the whole buildup of the book, you might, and I often do, see where there are like small gaps. And then I try to write and be more purposeful in how I write the poems that kind of, they're not necessarily the last poems in the book, but they're the last poems that I write for the book.
Do you remember the first poem, the first chronologically, the first poem you wrote for this book, and then chronologically the last poem you wrote for this book?
I definitely remember the last poem that I wrote for this book. The last poem that I wrote was a poem called More Please. And it's a sonnet. Yeah, there you go. It's a poem. It's a sonnet. And I was trying to find a way to write about, you know, the kind of fear that I had in thinking about my parents and the distance that was between us. And I had just had a conversation with Nicole, who's like one of my friends and who gets a shout out in the poem. So that was the last poem I wrote. I would say the first poem that I wrote, is a poem that I pulled from the archives. It's a poem called Bulls versus Suns, 1993. And that one was published.
Love that one.
That was published in the Lit magazine in like 2012. And so that's the oldest poem for sure.
I think that poem, I think I made a note. Let me make sure it's the right one. Oh no, different one. But I do remember that one. I made a note because on page 132, you have a poem that has like, it's the Down to My Elbows poem that ends with the Shakespeare line. And then on the next page, you have Rebuttal that has NBA 2K. And I was like, this is very much the exact two pages of this book that were written specifically for me. Like Shakespeare and basketball. I was like, this is very much exactly my shit. Though there are other poems that I was like, yes, there's much, much, much food in this book, which I love as a snack queen. There's a Cheetos poem, there's a tortillas poem. Just thank you for including food, because that's my personal joy. But there's, I felt like, and this is sort of a weird thing to admit into a microphone, so I hope this isn't horrible and people don't hate me, but I struggle with poetry. And a lot of the times when I'm trying to find a collection and trying to figure out what it is that I like about poetry, I turn to people that are exactly like me or very close to me, right? So like Black millennials who are talking about pop culture, right? And I really struggle if I'm reading like an older poet or a poet from a different background. And your book is the first time that I've read a book, and you're a millennial like me, so we have a lot of the same culture references, but you're Mexican and I'm Black, and I wasn't sure it was gonna like work for me, you know, just being really honest. And it really did. And it gave me a confidence, like, okay, I'm getting somewhere, like I could do it. But I also was like, this is so awesome because this poetry is so good, it doesn't really matter. And like, I think, you know, that's speaking to a lot of different things with me and also some great things about you. But I think the food and the basketball and the Shakespeare and the friends and all of that like really, really help, because it does feel not universal, because I hate when people say that shit, but it does feel like an invitation. I felt like an invitation, like I got to know you better and I got to see things that I already knew and loved in this collection. It's not a question. It's just me expounding. We'll take a quick break and then we'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for more than 3 years, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. At 52 iterations of their formula and counting, their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and aim to find the best quality ingredients available. Look, there's a reason I keep AG1 in my own morning routine. That's quality. For AG1, it isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because it's NSF certified for sport, one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by making it so there aren't a million different pills and capsules for me to keep track of. It's just one scoop of AG1 mixed in water every day. It could not be simpler. AG1's ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes folate, magnesium, and ashwagandha for stress support. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely looked forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out. Okay, microdosing. Have you tried it yet? I know a lot of folks swear by it. You should know that all sorts of people are microdosing to feel healthier and perform better. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. Whether you're a creative or you're super active, microdosing is for all walks of life. And that goes for people who are curious or longtime fans. These gummies get you right in that sweet spot where you're totally at peace after a workout or a shower or deep in the zone of a project. They're amazing for long hikes or just decompressing with a book under the covers, and they taste as good as they feel. Plus, if you're struggling at all with sleep or joint pain, they'll help with that too. Just take a gummy 1 hour before you want to fall asleep. We're all looking for ways to stay centered and in the moment, but keep our sharpness while in the creative flow or tackling day-to-day work. Microdose gummies are a great way to get that perfectly balanced effect. Even a quarter or half a gummy can go a long way. Get 30% off your first order plus free shipping today at microdose.com, promo code THESTACKS. It's available nationwide. That's microdose.com, promo code THESTACKS for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code THESTACKS.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we're back. I have to tell you my favorite poem in the collection. And then I want to hear from you about your favorites, but I'll tell you mine first. Maybe it's not my favorite poem in the collection because there's a few that popped to mind, but my favorite love poem I've ever read is in this collection. And it's Love Poem Beginning with the Yellow Cab. I just love that poem. Why is it so perfect?
That makes me so happy. I really like that poem too, especially as someone that finds it difficult to write love poems. I'm glad that one worked for you.
Oh my God, it's so early in the collection and I read it and I was like, ah, oh, I love him, I love her, I love Taxi Cat. Like, I was just like, this is the best thing I've ever read. I now love the color yellow. I don't even like yellow, but I loved it. Do you have favorites or are you a kind parent to your poems and you don't pick favorites?
You know, my relationship to the poems changes as I spend more time with them. So, for example, one of my current favorites is Eating Taco Bell with Mexicans.
Yes. Great. Great.
And it's one of my favorites because it's one that people request when I read at shows. And it surprised me at first. That, to me, that's kind of like a funnier, kind of sillier poem. But people really enjoy it. And so in turn, it has made me enjoy that one. And then I would say like the poems about my parents are really special to me and definitely probably the poems I'm the most proud of.
I love that. The one about the church, I didn't write down the name, the one about the church and your parents and the community and like waiting for salvation, that one, so good too. I mean, people who are listening, you have to get the collection because I'm just like saying lines from poems. So it's kind of like a clue for you. When you get the collection, you'll be able to know what I'm talking about. But there are, I mean, there's so many good ones. There's just, it's like such a, I guess this is not a question again, but maybe we can talk about this. But what else really works for me in this collection is that you have like the love poems, right? And you have the humor and it's pushed up like right up against the grief and the fear. There's so much like anxiety in this collection from you. And there's so much tenderness. And when you're writing these poems and you're actively working on the book. So I guess not like when you're writing something years ago, but as you're putting it all together, how are you thinking about balance and authenticity when it comes to your life and putting it down on paper?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I don't know that I think about authenticity a lot. I definitely think about balance. Sometimes I'll hear poets talk about how they're only writing for themselves. I don't really think that that's my experience. When I'm writing and also thinking about it in terms of how the reader will experience it. So I want to make sure that if there is a poem that feels heavy to me, that I'm following it up with some sort of lightness, that there's movement, right? That it's not, doesn't feel monotone to me. That's one of the things that I look for when I'm reading a book of poems, is even if I really like the first couple of poems, if I get six or seven more poems in the exact same register and emotional field, you know, it dulls me, right? It kind of loses me. And so I want my collection to feel surprising. Maybe you read a couple of love poems and you're like, all right, I think I know what this is. And then boom, there's a poem that kind of hits you in an unexpected way. So I definitely think about how to balance the book.
Are you thinking about that when you're writing it, or are you thinking about that more when you're putting it together?
I think about it more when I'm putting it together.
So when you're writing, you're sort of just writing what is coming to you. And then as you start to think about a book, you start to think like, okay, maybe this one doesn't make the cut this time because it's too much of the same or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. When I'm writing, it's a little bit of a mystery to me. And so when I sit down, I'm often searching. I'll write line after line and kind of throw it away until I write a line or an image that feels like a door opening, right? Like, this is the way I explain it. Writing poetry to me is sometimes the same feeling as when I go to therapy, which is that there are certain days where I like sit down with my therapist and I'll be like, I don't know what to tell you, doc. Like, I'm good this week. There's nothing on my mind. I feel good. We might as well skip today. And then the doctor will ask me, you know, one question, and suddenly I'll be like on the verge of tears. And it transports me, right? It opens up this place that I didn't know was underneath my kind of present self. And so poetry works the same way. Like, sometimes I'll write a word and something solid will be underneath that. And that's kind of how my writing process of each individual poem goes.
You mentioned the reader. I want to talk about audience a little bit. How are you / who are you imagining is the reader? How are you like, because if you're thinking about how they're reading it or their experience, you must have to think about who they could be to have a better understanding to write to them.
Yeah. So I begin by writing poems that I think my brothers will enjoy. I have three younger brothers and none of them are really like poetry majors, English majors. So I want them to really enjoy the poems. And then also poems that are impressive to my friends, right? I started writing as a high school student. And the thing that kind of kept me going was you know, that my friends would email me their poems and I'd be like, this is the best thing I ever read. And I'd want to like continue that and want them to feel that way about me. So those are the two audiences that I'm thinking about.
Okay. I love that. It's funny because I feel like I know many people, or I've read many people who are like kind of in your poet friend group at this point. Like many of the names you thanked at the end, I was like, oh, I know them. And it's funny to think of you all and then to think of like the old school, like beatnik poets, like doing the same shit, but like not having, you know, not having email, but being like, okay, like, I don't know their names, but you know, like Lenny Bruce or whatever, like,
yeah.
Here, beat this. Like, and I'm sure it's exactly how it was, but you're not taught that in school. You're not like, oh, Walt Whitman was like talking shit to his friends, being like, I bet you can't write like this, my guy.
That's great. I love imagining Walt like that. I'm sure that I really hope he was talking shit to his friends.
Yeah, I hope so too. Because I feel like we're sort of taught that like poets are like very serious and like uptight and sort of precious about their work. And I think there is some of that because I think there's like some neuroticism about the type of person who will like take 30 words and spend like 5 years trying to make it a poem. Like there's like something about like the specificity. But all the poets I've ever talked to are hilarious and competitive and like and silly and loving and tender and like maybe mean sometimes, like, and there's like so much more than the like I'm a poet and like I speak softly and I, you know, sit outside by the moonlight, and I'm sure you all do that too, but like I don't know, it's just knowing real life poets who are writing right now makes me think about olden time poets very differently.
I love that. I mean, I for one love sitting by the moonlight. I think we're getting a full moon today as we
I think soon
speak.
Yes.
And I'm very excited to see the full moon, but yeah, I mean, I think it's weird, right? People treat poetry, and I think certain types of visual art too, right? Like I had a friend from high school who became a glass blower, and it kind of stunned me to be like, wait, but you're just like a regular person, how did you get into glass blowing? That feels so esoteric, and you know, I didn't think about like who becomes glass blowers, but yeah, like, you know, it's like a profession, it's a craft, it's a hobby, it's something that we love, but at the end of the day, like it I don't really think about poetry as defining who I am. Like I think about I think if you wanted to get to know me, like you're probably a lot closer if you know any like long suffering basketball fans. You know what I mean? Like,
yes, of course.
Like the Chicago Bulls.
I was one. I'm the opposite of you. So I'm a Warriors fan, which means my whole childhood was long suffering and now we're in the success. And you're the opposite. You had a great childhood rooting for Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls. And now it's sadness in the wake of Jimmy Butler and Derrick Rose.
On and on.
Broken dreams.
My best friend in college was a Warriors fan. And so one of my best college memories was like commandeering like a common area in 2008 and watching the We Believe Warriors like shock the world.
I got to go to the game where Baron Davis dunked on Kirilenko. Is that?
Yeah. Yes. That's iconic.
I was at that game. Mother's Day game. Yes. We grew up. So this is, people might know this, but you don't. But we grew up. Eventually, my dad was able to like get us season tickets to the Warriors. These great seats. And he got two tickets. And my mom would go to all the like big games, like when Kobe would come to town, right? And my brother would go to like the mid-tier games. And I got to go to every Kevin Garnett game in the history of the Warriors versus the Timberwolves because they were so bad and we were so bad. And this, I think we like got tickets like, you know, the 13 win season or whatever. And now I like look back at a few years ago when they had only 13 losses or 12 losses. And I'm like, I did both. I've been here for all of it. But yes, that 2008, I remember staying up because I was living in New York, having to stay up so late to watch those fucking games. And now look at us. Prime time. All the time.
That's true. That's true.
Sorry to rub it in.
I can't relate. Honestly, those days are long gone for me.
They're in your rear view. But, you know, these things are cyclical. It'll come back. There's hope for you. I hope for you. I love that your personality. You're like, I'm not a poet. I'm just a Chicago Bulls fan. Just a sad, sad boy Chicago Bulls fan.
I mean, honestly, I feel like that might, like, there is some sort of link to the kind of despair, loneliness that comes from, like, watching those games. The kind of the hope at the beginning of the season and the way that it kind of deflates. And the rhythms of some of the poems. Like, I actually don't think that that's, like, I'm kidding, but I'm not.
I love it. I mean, Hanif is also a long-suffering basketball fan, right? He's a Timberwolves fan.
He's got
it
bad.
I feel like maybe there's something in there about basketball and sad boy poets.
Maybe.
Or sad boy basketball fan poets, I guess I should say it. Can I ask you about a sonnet, about sonnets?
Yeah.
You have a few sonnets in here, and then you have a almost sonnet. I can't remember the phrase used, but it's like close to a sonnet. I think of sonnet as Shakespearean sonnet, but there's obviously a different definition. What is it? 14 lines? Is that the only rule of a sonnet?
It depends, right? There's various kinds of definitions of rules. There's like a Petrarchian sonnet that has, I think, a different rhyme structure as well as a different meter than the Shakespearean sonnet. For me, the kind of two things that are important is the 14 lines, but that there's a volta, right? And so a volta is a turn. And so it's the point where, you know, the poem changes and shifts gears and rushes towards some kind of climax. For me, I started writing sonnets in part because it felt like a very familiar way to organize a poem. You know, when I consider, like, growing up in Poetry Slam and the way that at the end you wanted to leave the audience with something strong so that they would give you a good score, right? And I think that was, like, learning that tradition taught me how to write the endings of my poems. And so I think for me, the sonnet was just like a very natural fit in some ways.
I want to talk about how you write.
Yeah.
How often? How many hours? Where are you? Music or no? Snacks or no? Beverages or no? Rituals or no?
Yeah. I'm trying to put myself back into that place. So I tend to write in bursts. And so I don't necessarily write every day of every month of every year, but for, you know, 3 or 4 months sporadically, right, throughout the year, I'll write every day. And the way that I do it is it'll be basically the first thing that I do in the morning. I'll make a pot of coffee. I'll sit down at my desk, usually with some snacks for sure.
Say more. What kind? Talk about it.
It depends. I'm a big fan of Sour Patch Kids. I like to have those.
Yes. Thank you.
And then, you know, I also really like Gala apples, specifically Gala apples.
Refrigerated or no?
Refrigerated. I like them cold, okay. Cold and crisp.
Okay. Yes, okay.
You know, definitely some water, some coffee. And sometimes I'll sit at the desk for 3 or 4 hours. Sometimes the poems come much quicker. Sometimes all I get for my 3 or 4 hours is the beginnings of a poem, right? But I try to be, that's kind of my ritual, is do it first, do it in the morning, because if I procrastinate on writing, then either I won't do it at all, or when I sit down to write, my brain will be clouded with all of the things that happened during that day. And so I kind of want to bring a clear head to my writing.
When you're out in the world and you're not at your desk, like, prepared to write, do you have a notebook? Are you taking notes? I just imagine poets are writing down, like, oh, I saw a dog today, like, border collie, like, remember this. Or are you not doing that?
I keep a notebook with me, but very rarely do I, like, pull it out to jot little notes. More often, the thing that I'm doing when I'm traveling or when I'm not kind of at the desk is trying to read and pay attention and taking notes about what I'm seeing. Yes, for me, like, that being present in that way is more useful than always trying to jump into writing.
And then you said, you know, 3 or 4 months you're writing. What are you doing the other 8, 9 months?
Watching the Bulls and being miserable. I don't know. I mean, what I'm doing the other months is like really trying to read. It's also something that kind of changes, right? Before my first book came out, during those 8 or 9 months, I was, you know, working a full-time job and like being in relationship with all the people that I loved. After my first book came out, I began touring a lot more and visiting colleges. And so those 8 or 9 months were in part because I was just traveling a lot and visiting mm-hmm. different places. And so if I wasn't traveling, then I was resting. I was, you know, playing video games with my friends. I don't know. so that it kind of changes.
Got it. Okay. And what's a word you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Rhythm. Rhythm is a word I can never spell correctly. I always forget if it's an H, Y, H. Like, is it two H's? Does the H come right after the R? Is it R, Y, T, H, Y, M? I always mess it up.
It looks wrong also. The problem is that even if you get it right, it doesn't feel right. It feels like this can't possibly be right. I hate that word, truly. I didn't ask you about the title, but I want to talk about it. Talk and the cover. Will you tell us about both of those things?
Yeah, absolutely. So Promises of Gold is the title of the collection because I wanted a title that hinted at, you know, some of the like different conversations that were in the book, right? And I think, you know, we talked about the love poems. I think there's like a fair number of poems that are thinking about class identity, right? And then it also, that gold is really important when I think about like the history of colonization of Latin America. That's one of the things that brought, you know, the Spanish to the Caribbean and to Latin America, South America. And so for me, that gold is, it has two sides of it, right? Like it is part of what ruins or brings about the attempt to ruin a people and different peoples in the Americas. And it's also this kind of shining thing that still can be beautiful at times. So that's kind of how the title came to be. And then in terms of the cover, I really love the cover. And that was all my press, the visual editor at Henry Holt, whose name is Christopher Sergio. It was his idea. He wanted to kind of highlight the flowers and the different things that are highlighted in the text and then also bring in the luchador mask, which, I just think it looks really beautiful. So I'm really happy with it.
I love it. I think it's like so engaging. Is there anything that's not in this book that you wish could be or was?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I think, you know, honestly, if anything, I kind of, if I had it my way, I would have published a slightly slimmer book. I think I'd maybe take out some poems and not necessarily because I think they're bad poems. My preference is for like a slightly smaller book of poems. I think part of what I love about poems is that it can be a fast read, right? And so when you get these big tomes, you lose some of what poetry offers, which is that it can transport you somewhere else in a short amount of time. So that's probably the one thing I would change.
This is maybe a little esoteric, I don't know. How do you know when you're done with a poem? Because some of your poems are like 8 lines and then some are like 30 or something.
Yeah. I know that I'm finished with the poem when I feel it's like a particular feeling. You're right. I mean, it's different from like a short story or a chapter in a novel where, you know, maybe you arrive somewhere. Mm-hmm. In poetry, it's not necessarily that the plot is resolved, but there's a feeling or a slight texture that has revealed itself. So for me, that's what I'm looking for, is that something has surfaced and then it's really dependent on the poem. Sometimes once the emotion has been surfaced, and that's it. Sometimes there's an attempt to kind of reverse, or some, so like, I think about poems almost as like spells, right? To try and build a poem that changes that emotion. But yeah, I don't know. It's all about feelings. I think that's ending poems is one of the hardest things.
Well, it seems like it would be, because it sort of feels like you could keep going, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, seems like one of those things, like you're saying, like, because there isn't a specific place that you're writing to necessarily, like, it would be easy to do, at least for someone like me, it would be easy to do too much, right? Like, to not know how to stop. And I'm also thinking about, like, your background in spoken word, and, like, those poems are usually considerably longer than a lot of the poems in this book. So was that a difficult transition for you at all?
I think it was a difficult transition when I was a lot younger, right? But at this point, it's been probably easily at least 10 years since I participated in, like, a poetry slam. So even though I still read my poems out loud for audiences, I've had a lot of practice kind of writing specifically for the page. And so honestly, the short poem feels good to me, in part because I think one of the things that I struggled with when I was younger was always wanting to make sure that everyone understood exactly what I was saying. Mm. And so I was overwriting a lot of those poems, right? And being like, in case you didn't get it, this is about being Mexican. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And one more time, just for those of you in the back.
Yeah.
And so I feel much more confident as a writer. And so I think that gives me the ability to write the short poem and to be like, no, that where I ended it feels good. That's enough.
Oh, that's so cool that you could do that. It just feels like such, like, discipline, because I, as you can tell, I can't stop talking. what comes next for you? Do you know?
Yeah. So two things. I have a collaborative project with a photographer from Phoenix named Antonio Salazar, who takes these beautiful portraits of life on the south and west sides of Phoenix, two neighborhoods, you know, that struggle with violence at times. But he takes photos of really hard things in really tender and beautiful ways. And so in some ways, that reminds me a lot of the types of poems that I'm trying to write, where it's like treating everything, even the things that are hard, with tenderness and compassion. And so that project is called Por Siempre. It's mostly photography by Antonio, but it also features 15 of my poems that will be released by Haymarket in April. On April 4th. Yeah, so coming up soon.
Shit. So if you're listening to this, you've got 3 weeks.
There you go. And then the next solo project that I'm going to work on is a novel. Yeah, so I don't know how to write a novel. I have to figure it out.
Me neither. Good luck.
Thank you. But that is
I'll
what's
let you
next.
Know how you did.
Yeah, please.
But I can't help. For people who love Promises of Gold, what are other books you might recommend to them that are in conversation with what you've done?
Yeah, absolutely. I think about Danez Smith's book, Homie. I think that's a great one. Franny Choi has a collection of poems that was just released. The World Keeps Ending and The World Goes On. And then I think two books that are a little bit older that I'm always writing in conversation with are Eve Ewing's book, Electric Arches, and then Nate Marshall's book, Wild Hundreds. I love that book.
I loved Wild Hundreds.
It's
I know
so
Finna
good.
Was the one that got, like, all the attention, but I think Wild Hundreds is so good.
Finna is also amazing.
It is. Finna is also fantastic, yeah. But I just wish more people would go back and read Wild Hundreds.
Wild Hundreds is my jam. Like, I know that Nate probably feels like the poems in Finna are much stronger, probably. That makes sense, right? He's a different artist at that point. But for me, the poems in Wild Hundreds are just so excellent and perfect. And then the last book I would say is probably Natalie Diaz's When My Brother Was an Aztec, which is another book that I keep with me at all times and read from it whenever I'm feeling unsure. And it really is that beautiful to me.
I've never read any Natalie Diaz because I'm a little intimidated. Do you think that I can handle it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. I sometimes get scared to read people that everyone else says is great because I'm like, what if I'm not there yet?
No. That book is amazing. I really think you'll like it. I hope you like it.
I'll take your recommendation on it and then I will tag you when I finish and be like, so some notes for Jose. Two more. What do you hope people will keep in mind as they read Promises of Gold?
That's a good question. I hope people will be patient with themselves, right? You mentioned that sometimes people struggle getting into poetry. And I would say, you know, if there are particular poems that you don't understand, that's okay. Like, keep reading. I promise you that the book has a bunch of different types of poems. And if you don't understand one, it doesn't mean that you won't understand all of them. So be patient with yourselves, with yourself as a reader, and give yourself space to enter the poems in whatever way you can.
And then my last question for you is, if you could have one person, dead or alive, read your book, who would you want it to be?
My paternal grandmother and grandfather died before this book was published in Mexico. And I think recently I've been thinking a lot about like the way people keep stories and what happens when they're no longer with us. And particularly for my family, because like I've tried to trace some of the documents and the histories of where we've lived, and there just isn't any official paperwork. Like all of our histories were kept by people. And so I would love for them to be able to read the book for sure.
It's really beautiful. All right. Well, everyone, this has been a conversation with Jose Olivares, the author of Promises of Gold, a poetry collection, and also the author of a very shortly forthcoming 15 poems and a fantastic photo book from Haymarket that we're all going to go get too while we're at it. Jose, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Tracy. This was really fun.
Yay. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you again to Jose Olivares for being our guest. I'd also like to say a huge thank you to Clarissa Long for helping to make this conversation possible. Make sure you tune in on March 29th for the Stacks Book Club discussion of Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay with our guest, Shanita Hubbard. If you love the show and want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram and at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirages. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.